May it please the Court. After denying Wells Fargo its constitutional right to a jury trial, the trial court violated basic principles of Missouri law in entering a $3.2 million judgment on the plaintiff's wrongful foreclosure claim and quieting title in their favor. The first point I will address is that there was an absence of any justification for damages in the record. As a threshold.
Before we go there,
yes.
You claim that the trial court erred by not giving you the jury trial, correct?
If
the court agrees with you and we remand for a jury trial, what's to prevent you then from waiving it and this whole thing having been a charade to extend this case another 6 to 9 months?
I'm sorry, Your Honor, so you're asking if it were remanded and at that point we then waive the jury trial?
If we remand for the jury trial you say you wanted and you get down there and then you waive it.
Well, I mean, that would be our constitutional right to have the opportunity to indeed exercise that opportunity. That's not what we're certainly doing in this case. We've been very clear during the course of the trial and otherwise that we were requesting a jury. But given this court's decision in Llewellyn and Watts, the jury trial is inviolate. The right to a jury trial is inviolate. And the Missouri statutes provide four exclusive methods in which to waive that jury trial. Those were not done here, and in fact, the opposite was done. There was a loud and insistent request for a jury throughout the course of the trial, and that was denied. So it is within the constitutional purview of any party before a Missouri court to decide whether to proceed with the jury trial or not. We were not given that opportunity. Our jury trial was denied at the outset.
But in a practical sense, since the trial court's entering sanctions against the defendants, against you, for not allowing you to present any evidence, in light of that, what matters were left for a jury to decide?
Well, Your Honor, the court in this case, the trial court, did not enter a default judgment. The pleadings were stricken, but Rule 61.01 lists those as in the disjunctive, as or, strike pleading or enter a default judgment. That
right,
was not
I understand
done.
That, but
yes.
So there was no default judgment clearly entered, but you were not allowed to present any evidence. So what issues or matters were left for the for a jury to decide?
To determine whether the plaintiffs could submit a case with competent substantial evidence to justify liability, and then to determine the amount of damages and what amount of damages are appropriate.
Is the first question a question of law?
A question of law.
The submissibility question.
The submissibility of the case to the jury. Well, Your Honor, I would say that it is a question of law as to the appropriate mechanism of what happens when sanctions are in place and what happens next. And I would submit to you that saying that a party then cannot exercise its right to a jury trial to have a jury hear that evidence would be in violation of that constitutional right.
Are you saying that the jury still had to determine liability even if there was unopposed evidence? Because submissibility would be the same to the court or to the jury, right? The question of whether a submissible case was made.
That is correct. The jury would have to hear the evidence and make a finding of liability. Now, that does not take away the sense that a judge could direct a verdict if what was presented did not meet the, and that certainly would be a question of law, Your Honor.
Mm-hmm.
But in terms of having that opportunity to present that evidence to the jury, that's, again, is inviolate. That's something that must be provided to any party in a court in Missouri.
I know it didn't happen in this case, but do you think that in a civil case that both sides could purport to waive a jury in accordance with the statute, but the judge decide to require one anyway?
I don't, Your Honor. I think that the way that the cases have interpreted, such as the Meadowbrook case, they have upheld the provisions in 510.190.2 of the Missouri Revised Statutes as those being the four exclusive methods.
Well, I understand there's a way to waive the right.
Yes.
But does the court necessarily have to accept your waiver?
Well, Your Honor, that may be a case of first impression. I think the statutes provide a basis for that waiver. In a situation where a judge would decide that he or she would not accept that waiver, it would seem that a party would have the opportunity to exercise a right to a jury or not. And so I, in thinking this through, I'm not sure that a judge would have the ability to override a complete waiver by the parties if they follow what's mandated in the Missouri revised statutes.
Would you move on to the special damages, emotional distress damage, and what evidence is required to prove it?
Yes. Thank you, Your Honor. The largest component of damages in this case were $200,000 of emotional distress damages. There was no medical testimony presented whatsoever to substantiate those. And I should add, they were not pled as special damages as required by Rule 55.19.
But has this court ever required, you know, expert testimony on that area?
Yes, Your Honor. The Fettick case, the 2001 Fettick case from this court, provided clearly that in a case of willful fraud, that in order to substantiate emotional distress damages in that case, there had to be medical testimony to meet the two prongs of the Bass v. Nooney test of being medically diagnosable and medically significant. And especially honing in on the medically diagnosable, the Fettick case upheld a grant of summary judgment because in that case the plaintiff was unable to come up with any such evidence to satisfy the medically diagnosable prong. And that's the way that's been interpreted. We cite the Van Eaton case in our briefs. That is a bright line rule that in this sort of situation.
Well, there are a number of cases that haven't required medical testimony, though.
Well, Your Honor, I wouldn't say that there's a number. There were a couple of cases prior to the Fettick decision in the Court of Appeals, the Lipari and the Fuss cases, which found that in very unique circumstances that for intentional torts where damage was not an element, such as an assault case, where damage was not an element and that emotional distress damages were the necessary and probable consequences, those decisions found that that the torts could proceed without medical testimony. But I would add that those do predate the Fettick decision, and I think the better approach would be a bright-line rule that in these types of cases where emotional distress damages, again, given just the very sort of vague nature of emotional distress and how to quantify that it makes sense to have a limiting principle that you must have medical testimony to support those damages. And again, that's the logical outgrowth of
But why here? He's not trying to get medical money, you know, recompense for money he spent on medical treatment. He's saying, this stressed me out, this caused me many problems. I was really nervous, I thought I had heart problems, and so forth and so on. As a result of this, we clearly say garden variety emotional distress, stress caused by being fired, by things like that, does not require medical testimony because you're not trying to get reimbursed your medical expenses. You're talking about your stressful reaction to a situation which any layperson can understand. Why isn't this the same, or why is it different?
Well, Your Honor, a couple of things. I think that the garden variety that you mentioned is limited to the MHRA context via the Dean opinion.
Well, nothing limits it. We apply it there. And why doesn't it apply here? Why are you're saying it doesn't? I understand both arguments. Tell me why this falls on one side and not the other.
Well, again, we would say bright line rule Fettick. But if you look at the Lipari and the Fuss cases, if we were to follow sort of an exception to the what we call the Fettick principle, then in those cases, again, there was a two-part test. Are damages a part of the actual cause of action? In assault, in one of those cases, it was an assault case, those are presumed. You don't need to prove damages. In a wrongful foreclosure action, you do. And then second, an assault case, you know, there's been an assault, those sort of damages would be presumed. In a wrongful foreclosure case, you could not assume that. The circumstances that give rise to wrongful foreclosure are quite varied.
Yeah, I saw you said that in your brief, and you said, well, if it's a commercial foreclosure, you're probably not going to be affected by it. But we're talking about somebody's home. Can't anyone assume if you're put out of your home, whether rightfully or wrongfully, so you may or may not be entitled to damages for it, but how it's always going to be stressful to the homeowner in a personal foreclosure.
And Your Honor, I think it's true that in foreclosure or any number of any legal claims, litigation itself and resulting from that can be stressful. There's no doubt. That's why, given sort of the vague and amorphous nature of emotional distress damages, that makes it even more important that there's a threshold, that there's a gatekeeper to go into courts and say, have medical testimony to tie up. Yes, this medical testimony, this medical condition this stress is related to XYZ, so that we tie up the causation. I think that's critical.
And then why don't we apply that into where you've lost your job? We say that the layperson is very able to understand that garden variety emotional distress. Why would it be different for a home than there?
Well, again, Your Honor, I think that any individual case, you could point to certain facts and say, yes, that's stressful. But the key is that for torts, for there to be sort of a clear understanding for the litigants, there has to be this bright line. And FedEx has given us that bright line, that in willful fraud, you need the medical testimony as a gatekeeper. The Henry case, 2014 from the Court of Appeals, said the same thing in a breach of fiduciary duty case. These are examples where you need a gatekeeper. And you can think of a breach of fiduciary duty case, again, as being very, very a stressful situation. A fiduciary, there's been a breach. But again, there's a need for there to be a bright line so that you don't have these sort of vague damages. There has to be a tie-up. And I think that the FedEx decision expresses that very well and provides an appropriate mechanism for courts to address that.
Thank you.
I would quickly point out that was the largest component of damages. The other damages were also special damages not pled. There was a diminution of value, which is completely contrary to this court's Atkinson and Smith cases. There was no showing of loss of equity. And then also the other part of damages were the cost.
Well, there was
repairs.
Evidence of testimony, right, of the homeowner that it lost value.
Well, the testimony, though, did not meet the formula of the Atkinson case. Those cases say that on the date of the foreclosure sale, there has to be a loss of equity, fair market value versus the amount of liens on the property. There was none of that. Mr. Holm testified as to the value of his house at the time of trial, some 6.5 years after that. And even then, the value was lower than what was probably the debt, which was the sale price.
So you're saying no consequential damages are allowed here?
I am saying that if there are any special damages, those would have to be pled. This is not the measure of wrongful foreclosure damages established very clearly in the Atkinson and Smith cases. I would quickly point out that, again, there was no showing of damages in this case because there was no showing of competent substantial evidence that there was no default on the part of the plaintiffs that would give right to foreclose at the time. And as a result, bedrock principle of Missouri law, there can be no damages in that situation under the tort of wrongful foreclosure. I see that my time's up.
Thank you. We'll hear from you on rebuttal.
I feel at least entitled to, as a matter of personal privilege, acknowledge my sense of loss, looking at the empty chair here and the warm face that used to greet all participants here. I think the entire bar, as well as I know the court, is feeling that loss today. But I really felt so as I was standing here. Contumacious. Contumacious. The word over and over kept coming to me as I walked over here, and that's because I had to play Siri to know how to say it. But it means so much and expresses so efficiently what went on here. The Western District's opinion states in the strongest terms how below the standard of respect and obedience that we ask litigants to conform their conduct to occurred in this case. Judge Martin's opinion says that she has no concern about the sanction whatsoever, emphasizing the breadth of the conduct that was egregious in this case.
But there's a difference between whether or not the sanction was deserved and what the legal impact is of the sanction. And there's a difference between entering a default, entering judgment for the other side, and that didn't occur in this case, did it?
Well, it's an interesting question in regard to what Judge Elliott did. Judge Martin found that the effective thing that he did was, in fact, to default them in the way that this came out, but gave the plaintiff the right to have a jury trial if the plaintiff, the non-offending party, so chose. But there was no requirement upon the court to grant a jury trial in this case because the conduct at issue would have, as in your Leclerc decision that you authored, Judge, that she cites down below, the conduct would have allowed a default and foreclosed a jury trial to the defendant in this case.
But the court didn't say default.
He did.
He didn't say enter judgment.
He didn't say it directly, but he did say this is tantamount to a default. And as he was entering the sanction, giving the plaintiff the right to have a jury trial. The reality is,
but the defendant has an equal right, don't they, to a jury trial?
Not if they're in default. And if it's a de facto default, the answer is no.
In a default judgment, the plaintiff still has to prove damages, correct?
Yes.
And the default judgment rule specifically says any party may request a jury trial on that issue.
But in the Leclerc case that Judge Breckenridge authored, she found that in the range of sanctions that could be awarded, a denial of a jury trial was one of them, because a party so forfeits their participatory right.
But the court didn't enter a judgment on damages. It didn't, damages still had to be proved. There was evidence put on. Why wasn't defendant entitled to a jury trial, at least on that?
Well, I mean, he could have entered a damages without a trial. Mm-hmm. He made the plaintiff prove up its damages for his own edification so that he was sure that his judgment met constitutional limits. What the court did to assure that he was confident that what he was doing was fair under the circumstance should not place a limit or grant rights to the defendant who was in such contempt of the court's procedures, even so much so that they didn't file jury instructions as he directed.
But they did bring them, though.
No, they didn't bring them. They said they brought them. They said they were out in the car or on their computer. It was a dog ate my homework excuse. They never produced them to the court.
Have they never been there, even though they're not formally filed?
I'm sorry?
They've never been presented informally to
never.
The court or to you?
Never. And so the reality is that the judge believed, based as he should be protected in this instance, to disbelieve them when they showed up on the morning of trial, because they'd been informed the day before that Mr. Lay had waived. They knew in Clinton County you had to have more notice than the morning of to get a jury. They wanted a continuance, in fact. And so the judge thought it was a subterfuge based upon the totality of the circumstance that they were now requesting a jury trial. And he had a right to believe them. Look, he had ordered them four separate times to produce documents and warn them that sanctions were coming if they continued to hide the ball. They failed to produce two witnesses at his direction. They lied to him, he said, twice. Now, I've looked at all the cases for sanctions. I've never seen more egregious conduct than existed here. And so he was absolutely entitled, according to Judge Martin, and I think that she's right, to say default. So if the court is saying all he needs to do on remand is say default and the judgment can be entered in this way, I think that elevates form over substance. I think that Judge Breckenridge was right in Leclerc to say that when a party so violates the principles and understandings and participatory rights that we all undertake as members of the bar and as litigants, they do forfeit their right to a trial by jury at some point. And I think in this case, it is one such example that must be preserved for trial courts to be able to enforce their orders. Without it, I'm sorry, Judge, can I finish this thought?
Sir.
Without it, think about this. Think about what may be going on here. You would be allowing someone to so react to a court in this contemptuous way and say, but we don't think that a rural jury is going to award any money. So we're going to come up here and act whatever way we can, but we still have a right to convince the rural jury not to award any damages against us. I mean, the judge has to have the ability to judge the circumstances and the motives of counsel based upon the totality of his engagement with them. And here, he didn't have just one encounter. He had over a year of warnings and begging them to comply. And they didn't. And when they showed up without instructions on the morning of trial and claimed they wanted a jury, he disbelieved them.
Under 510.190.2, it does not cover the circumstance where someone asked for a jury on the eve of trial.
No, it doesn't.
So do we have to find for him, for it to be subterfuge, do we have to find that there can be a way to waive jury trial outside of 510.190.2 by not requesting it until the eve of trial?
I think that it's inherent within what you've already provided under Rule 61, that the judge has the full range of powers to supervise the conduct of counsel and parties in front of them, including defaulting them. And this was a de facto default. The fact that he doesn't say default is irrelevant to the fact that within the range of punishments available to him for the conduct, he can deny them the jury trial, and he did.
Is there anything, if assuming just for the purpose of this question, we didn't find it was a default, I think the question was, is there any other basis, a latches kind of a thing where you just can't ask on the eve of trial for a jury trial for the first time?
Yes, I guess you could. I hadn't considered that argument, but it's certainly, the latches idea certainly is relevant to the fact that they...
I wasn't trying to suggest something, but asking you had no...
No, but I understand the court's point. But yes, it is tantamount to latches in this regard. They didn't ever express an interest in having a jury trial. They didn't show up with any instructions. They were asking for a continuance. They saw that this was an opportunity that a jury was not present, and therefore to request one. That's what the judge believed occurred in this circumstance. And I think that the judge has to be allowed the discretion, based upon the totality of the circumstances, judging the demeanor of the witnesses and the lawyers and their conduct before him, to be able to say, I have the ability to hear this thing under Rule 61 without a jury, and I think that he does have that ability.
Can you tell me what exactly they were asking for a jury trial on? It seems to me they asked for a jury trial on the cross claim, counterclaim, and now as to damages, right?
Yeah, but see, everything was stricken except the determination of damages. Right. I mean, the affirmative defenses were stricken. They had no right to put any of that on. And the point was made earlier, I think, by Judge Russell, that once those things were established, what was there for a jury to try? The only thing left would have been damages. But the plaintiff was, their right to request a jury for damages was preserved. Mr. Lay waived those on the morning of trial, which was his right, and the defendant had indicated no interest in a jury trial up until that point. So the only question would be, did we need a jury to determine damages under this circumstance? And he heard the evidence on this and wrote a very careful order on the subject, and Judge Martin goes over in great detail the evidence supporting those damages, so we know, to the extent that we're concerned about constitutional protections, that there was evidence in the record by which you could find damages in this case, both actual and punitive. And so I think that constitutional rights were protected given the circumstances of this unique case and the conduct of Wells Fargo under the circumstances.
But sanctions aside, the wrongful foreclosure count ordinarily would be tried to a jury if either party, if both parties did not waive.
That's correct.
Okay.
That would be correct.
And then there was a quiet title count that
would have been judge tried.
Would, after the jury trial.
Could be contemporaneously. It depends on what the judge wanted to do. You could do both at the same time and have the judge hear the evidence at the same time that the jury and reach its, count on count two and three.
It'd be a cleanup. Equitable cleanup,
yes.
Either on the same record or a different record.
Right.
But the first count would have ordinarily.
Ordinarily, that's right. And they had a right. And they had a right to that if they simply participated in the case. He gave them four chances, for heaven's sake. I mean, they appeared before him and told him falsehoods to his face. A court shouldn't have to be subjected to this kind of treatment by a litigant simply because you know, you're out of town or whatever the excuse is that they wanted to put forward or that they didn't understand our rules maybe. I don't know.
Can you address their argument that you didn't make a prima facie case that basically you admitted that they were a proper holder? And that they had a right to foreclose?
Well, I think Judge Martin addresses this directly by saying that there was evidence in the record that there was a modification agreement that the plaintiff was complying with, and therefore they were not in default. She finds that specifically in her opinion.
And what about their argument that you admitted you were behind on your payments?
Well, no, what we said was, what she credits, in Judge Martin, that is, in her order, is the testimony from the home that they had entered into a modification agreement with Wells Fargo, that they had accepted and that they were current with that modification agreement, so they were not in default. And that's what she credits and says, therefore, they had no right to foreclose in regard to count one.
You think there was a question of fact as to whether they had to send the money by noon and so forth, and
well, I think that relates to the punitive damages in the Western District's analysis, and here's why it's relevant. Yes, there was a factual issue, but because the pleadings were stricken, they had no right to put their counter evidence in. But our evidence showed, and I think very persuasively, that in fact they were told. I mean, this is what sent Mr. Holm to the hospital, that he had to get a certified check to the lawyers for Wells Fargo's offices. That day, and they said, you can fax a copy and mail and Federal Express it for tomorrow and we'll call the sale completely off. The lawyers contact the homes an hour after the sale already occurred to tell them the directions to send all this. And so there's no question that, in fact, they were directed in this regard and that they complied with the request to bring the loan current. Even though they believed that they had not fallen into dishonorment of the loan at that point in time, they were not in default because of the previous agreement. They did everything right in this case. They did everything to protect their home. Not only did they try to send them the $10,000 they requested, but they then sent $8,000 that they subsequently said would bring the loan current, and Wells Fargo kept it for a year without even sending it back. What's a Missouri homeowner to do in this circumstance? They did everything right. They tried to bring their loan current in the middle of this financial crisis, entered into a modification agreement. Then when they said, we're not going to honor that modification agreement, they sent them the full amount that they wanted, and they said, oh, it was the wrong amount, and it wasn't a cashier's check. Then they admitted that was a lie. And then they said, oh, well, it got here 4 hours late. No, it didn't. It got there in the time that you told them to send it. And then if you'll send us $8,000, we'll bring it current. Then they hold it for a year. I mean, there was plenty of evidence by which the judge could find punitive conduct in this case, and the award was tempered in light of the fact that the evidence at trial was that Wells Fargo makes more than this every hour of the day that it's in business.
Counsel, before you sit down, I know you're out of time. I wanted you to address your opponent's argument about double recovery, getting actual damages and having the property, the title quieted in your client.
Yes, well, Judge Martin's order opinion does say that. We made the argument below that, in fact, because the quiet title action was against Freddie Mac, and that we could have the remedy of quiet title against Freddie Mac and the damages awarded against Wells Fargo. The reason, of course, is Wells Fargo had all of the bad conduct. Freddie Mac, when they were deposed, their representative, Mr. Meyer, said, we didn't have any idea that Wells Fargo was doing any of this stuff. We want reinstatements. We would have reinstated. The representative of Wells Fargo, I mean, of Freddie Mac says, we have the agreement. We have the servicing agreement. We will produce it to you. The lawyers for Wells Fargo would not produce it.
But so, was it double recovery is the question?
So no, I don't think that it's double recovery, I mean, particularly in light of the way that she limited the damages to the emotional distress damages awarded against Wells Fargo. You could quiet title based upon the way that she structured the damages very effectively. That is to say, the punitive damages and the emotional damages against Wells Fargo, but quiet title against Freddie Mac, then there is no double recovery. It's against two different parties, and it's two essential different theories of liability.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Your Honors, to frame the issue, if this court decides as a matter of law that the plaintiffs were not entitled to damages, then you don't even reach the jury trial issue. And in this case, again, the evidence showed that at the time foreclosure proceedings began in May of 2008, and that's when the plaintiffs allege in their petition they began. If they were in default at that point, there can be no damages. Bedrock principle of wrongful foreclosure law. What plaintiff's counsel was just referring to about this attempted reinstatement in August of 2008, none of that can have any bearing on whether or not the plaintiffs were in default when foreclosure proceedings commenced. If they were in default at that point, absolutely, that's the end of the story. They can get no damages. All that would
what
be
evidence,
left.
What evidence was there that they were in default?
The evidence that they were in default, first of all, the plaintiffs introduced a payment history showing that their last payment was in February 2008, well before May 2008. They also introduced testimony from a Wells Fargo corporate representative via deposition that confirmed that. And plaintiffs don't contest that in the response brief that the last payment made was in February 2008. They also admitted the successor trustee's deed, which contained recitals, which under Missouri revised statutes are prima facie evidence of the statements there, and that established that they had missed payments. Also, the fact of their attempted reinstatement check in August was over $10,000. Under the note, their payments were approximately $950 a month. Just the amount of that check shows that prior to May 2008, they were in default. So the evidence is complete and unequivocal that they were in default at that time. So the later reinstatement
you agree you agree that the trial court could believe or disbelieve any part or all of the evidence presented?
I do,
and
Your Honor.
What's the standard of review on submissibility?
I do, Your Honor, but there has to be competent and substantial evidence. And the only testimony was a statement of Mr. Holmes's belief that he was not in default.
Well, they also had the evidence of the insurance proceeds, and I know your argument that they weren't required to apply them, but they presented evidence that they presented the 4,000 plus.
They do in two things on that. Their deed of trust, they entered into evidence and also attached to the petition, shows that there was no obligation for Wells Fargo to accept that, and the amount of the check was not enough to cover what they were in default in May 2008. So that's in the record as well.
Do you raise a claim that the result was against the weight of evidence, or is your claim just based on sufficiency?
Our claim is based upon the application of a lot of facts under the Murphy v. Caron standard. Mm-hmm. That based upon what the facts were presented at the trial court, there could be no verdict in that favor.
Do you suggest that if we decided that you had a right to jury trial, which you did not waive, and sent it back down, that they would be limited to the evidence they put on the first time?
I do believe that the record was closed at that point.
Well, if a new trial is a new record, so are you saying that they would be limited to the evidence they put on in the first trial?
I think there would be some discretion with the trial court there, and I would add that if that happened, the discovery sanctions in this case were very inappropriate, and the defendant should be allowed to present their...
But setting that aside, they can put on whatever evidence they want in the second trial, it would seem to me, and then the court would rule on whether it's admissible, I suppose.
They could. And our point is they had the unfettered ability to put on whatever they wanted, to create whatever record they had. And in this case, it still did not rise to the level of being a case that could substantiate any damages whatsoever.
Yeah, but you can't have it both ways. Either you were denied your right to a jury trial, and we'll go back, and they'll put on their evidence, and then you can make a motion for a directed verdict and challenge the submissibility. Or you can drop that argument and rely on the lack of a submissible case in the trial that you're no longer contesting was void as unconstitutional from the get-go.
Well, Your Honor, respectfully, I would say that once the plaintiffs elected to move forward and create a record, even though the jury trial issue had been raised, that they put at risk that the record that they presented before the court would not be sufficient to substantiate
damages.
But if you
get all the relief you request because of a denial of a jury trial, I don't understand why the whole case wouldn't be retried again.
And Your Honor,
you're going to have to help me with that again.
If And if that was the decision before reaching the record that was presented at the trial court, then yes, it would be a retrial. But my point is, again, they had the unfettered ability to put on whatever they wanted, and what they put on does not equate with a finding of liability or damages.
Counsel, before you sit down, I pulled up the FedEx case because I thought perhaps I'd missed something in it, but it does not say you have to present medical testimony. It simply applies Bass v. Nooney to the fraud context, and Bass v. Nooney did not say you have to have a physician's testimony or an expert, which we do say in medical malpractice cases very clearly. It says your emotional distress has to be medically diagnosable and significant, and points out that when asked had he ever sought treatment for his emotional distress, he said no, and he hadn't lost any hours from work. And they said that means it wasn't medically diagnosable or significant. They don't say you didn't present an affidavit from a doctor or a doctor's testimony, and that's why you can't recover.
Your Honor, in headnote 10, which I believe is what you were referring to.
I'm talking about what the court said as opposed to the headnote. But that's under 10, though, yes.
Correct. Yes, I'm looking at the section of the opinion which corresponds to headnote 10. And in that, they cite portions of the deposition testimony. And again, they asked if he had ever sought treatment for the emotional distress.
The court nowhere said there you have to present a medical expert, nor did they say they were rejecting it because they didn't have an expert. They rejected it because in that testimony he said he'd never sought treatment and never lost work, and they found that was not sufficient to be medically diagnosable, not that you had to be diagnosed and have a doctor.
And Your Honor, again, as we've cited cases in addition to this, which show that it's interpreted to mean that there has to be medical testimony. But I would point out, medically diagnosable. Just that phrase, medically diagnosable. That phrase is inherent that there needs to be some sort of expert testimony.
But counsel, when we want, I mean, I understand your argument that you think it could be, but we always look at things and see how other language is used in other cases. And we have other cases that say you have to have an expert. You've got to have medical testimony. You've got to have causation. We don't say that here. So we have to give some meaning to using a different test or standard in this context than we do in medical malpractice cases where we do absolutely require an expert.
I think that the adjective here, medically. I think that inherent in that, the old phrase, I'm not a doctor, but I play one on TV, a jury can't play a doctor. There has to be that reasoned opinion from a medical professional to establish that. Otherwise, the phrase medically has no meaning.
Thank you.
And I would just quickly point out, on the abuse of discretion, our brief goes into great detail countering that. There's another side to that story. It was an abuse of discretion in this case to strike the pleadings when lesser sanctions were available, and there was ample good faith attempts to meet the discovery burden on documents that were irrelevant. The servicing agreement was irrelevant.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Case is submitted. Thank you.